overcome the limit. One was to endure the lack of currency, and the other was to bring in gold from other regions through trade and loot. The last method was currency degradation, by making more coins with the same amount of gold. People began to deceive others by making new coins using clipped edges of existing coins.
And up until 1696, coins were struck onto a rough blank. So you used to be able to, if you were a very unscrupulous silversmith, you could clip the edges and get free silver. And so there were many laws that were passed to try and stop this. And in 1696, what they did was that they made sure that all the coins were circular with a milled edge. So that stopped the practice of coin clipping.
This is the origin of how the coin edges look today. Clipping of coin edges brought many problems. The value of currency fell, and prices began to inflate. New coins had to be issued to win people's trust. Sir Isaac Newton stepped up to solve all these problems.
And one of his big responsibilities was to prevent forgery. So one of the ways he did that was by making sure that all the coins had a milled edge around them, because if the edge is milled with little grooves, it's impossible to clip off a little bit of the coin.
The grooves on the coins that Newton made are used on today's coins as well. The grooves mark the human greed for gold. Gold, however, was never used as the main currency in the East. As the value of gold developed the currency system in the West, brass coins backed by the government played a similar role in the East. Whether it be gold or a brass coin, if the receiver had trust in it, that was enough. People had faith in the government. The first coins in the East were made during the Jin Dynasty. They believed the sky was round and the land was square, so they made a round coin with a square hole in the middle. This shape became the basic shape of Eastern coins for 2,000 years. The trust of currency gave birth to the world's first paper money in China. Gyoza, issued in Buxong in 1023, was the first paper money. When Emperor Kublai Khan of the Yuan Dynasty mass-produced bozhou and circulated them through Eurasia, the era of paper currency began. Paper money was made of paper, but it ceased to be just ordinary paper. Kublai Khan is described as an alchemist in the travels of Marco Polo. Paper currency was like magic to the Westerners who were using gold coins. During the Yuan Dynasty, the government forcefully retained gold, silver, and copper, and with its guarantee, paper money was issued. With the circulation of paper money, less money was spent on producing coins, which led to a better financial status of the government, and thus led to a more active commerce. Replacing the gold with paper money opened up a new golden era in the East. At the end of the 15th century, gold had cast a spell on people and made them cross the oceans, risking their lives. But the lives of Europeans were also shaken up by gold. At the time, the population which had been devastated by the plague was bouncing back. Price of commodities was also increasing. Moreover, as gold and silver from the New World poured into Europe, prices soared uncontrollably. The price revolution of the 16th century began. Treasure from the New World created a large gap between the rich and the poor.
And this is at a time when that is much more than a week's earnings in the late. It's more like 2 weeks' earnings. So it is a lot of time to earn the smallest coin. And therefore, ordinary people do not have gold coins. It is something for the rich to have.
Prices quadrupled and sextupled. First, landowners who received a consistent amount of rent went bankrupt. Farmers who didn't have money to rent land became wage laborers. On the other hand, the royal families and noblemen enjoyed an unprecedented extravagance. Gold instantly spread throughout European countries, and in its wake, only collapsed industries and financial crisis remained. Such was the curse of gold. The price revolution continued on for over 100 years without any resolution. It was the longest inflation in history. When commerce expanded and capitalism developed, a barter economy emerged. A system of an exchange of promissory notes for foreign currency began. 48 types of gold coins used in Europe in the 16th century were all exchangeable. Thus, financial innovation was propelled by the power of gold. In the early 19th century, gold faced a new era. Money was dependent upon the value of gold. A system of gold and money exchange emerged. Since then, history repeatedly introduced and discarded the gold standard. In 1819, England pegged the value of pounds to gold and circulated paper money that could be exchanged for gold at any time. By 1870, most countries had adopted the gold standard, and the pound, which could be exchanged for gold, became the key currency around the world.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
The New York Times has recently reported that with Omicron surging in the US, economists warn that the 1-2 punch of expiring aid and rising cases could put a chill on the once red-hot economic recovery and cause severe hardship for millions of families already living close to the poverty line. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Jake Johnson, journalist. This article is published under the heading, Huge Increase in U.S. Child Poverty Feared as Tax Credit Expires Amid Omicron Wave. Stay tuned for more. The lapse of Democrats' expanded child tax credit program at the end of last month has progressive lawmakers and advocates vocally warning of a major spike in child poverty in the new year, just as the Omicron variant wreaks havoc across the U.S., fueling a staggering rise in infections and hospitalizations. While some research suggests the highly transmissible Omicron strain causes less severe disease than other mutations, the enormity of the current wave is driving fears of widespread and potentially sustained societal disruptions, with disproportionate impacts on families without the resources to weather more pandemic-induced economic chaos. Approved as part of the coronavirus relief package that Biden signed into law in March 2021, the enhanced child tax credit provided eligible families with monthly payments of up to $300 per child under the age of 6 and $250 per child between the ages of 6 and 17. Recent survey data indicates that the payments brought millions out of poverty and helped many low-income families afford food. But thanks to the opposition of Senator Joe Manchin and every congressional Republican, the program expired at December's end, cutting off a key lifeline at what anti-poverty activists see as the worst possible moment. Rhode Island Poor People's Campaign recently said yet another sign of the misaligned priorities of this country. Programs of social uplift are sacrificed to the war economy and militarism. The New York Times reported recently that with Omicron surging, economists warned that the 1-2 punch of expiring aid and rising cases could put a chill on the once red-hot economic recovery and cause severe hardship for millions of families already living close to the poverty line. Anna Lara, a mother of two young children in Huntington, West Virginia, told the Times that without the boosted CTC, it's going to be hard next month. Just thinking about it, it really makes me want to bite my nails to the quick, Lara said. Honestly, it's going to be scary. It's going to be hard going back to not having it. Representative Pramila Jayapal, chair of the Congressional Progressive Caucus, wrote recently that it is totally unacceptable for the Senate to let the CTC lapse. In November, the House of Representatives passed the version of the Build Back Better Act that would extend the enhanced CTC payments for another year. Jayapal wrote, the Senate must act quickly to pass the Build Back Better Act and restore the child tax credit for millions of families who are counting on it. The pandemic isn't over. The relief to withstand it shouldn't stop. More than a million people in the U.S. tested positive for coronavirus. Recently, a global daily record said the Washington Post reported recently that more than 103,000 Americans were hospitalized with COVID-19, the highest number since late summer, when the Delta variant of the coronavirus triggered a nationwide surge in cases. Pediatric hospitalizations have also risen at an alarming rate during the Omicron wave. According to a recent analysis by the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, nearly 10 million children are at risk of slipping back below the poverty line or deeper into poverty if Congress doesn't extend the monthly CTC payments. Without congressional action, the CTC will revert back to its previous and far more exclusionary form with yearly lump sum payments. The Senate Democratic leadership has vowed to move ahead with Build Back Better negotiations this month, but it's unclear how much progress will be made toward a final deal as Manchin continues to obstruct.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a big welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today.
Stay tuned with Africa Today.
Africa Today.
South Africans are calling on their government to withdraw its permission to Shell Oil for a seismic survey along the country's pristine wild coast region. Now, this area is home to some of the country's most undisturbed marine life and a major source of income for locals. Last December, protesters gathered in Cape Town and chanted slogans against Shell, an Anglo-Dutch multinational oil and gas company. Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a warm welcome to Africa Today, a weekly program that gives you an alternative view of events making headlines in Africa. Today, we are focusing on Shell's move to create a 3D model of offshore oil and gas reserves by using seismic waves in South Africa's wild coast region. Environmentalists say the operation will not only affect marine creatures, but also fishing communities in the wild coast whose livelihoods depend on the marine life. In the second part of our program, we shall talk about Zimbabwean health professionals who are leaving their country amid the COVID-19 pandemic to work in the United States, Britain, Australia, and neighboring countries. Stay tuned as our experts give you their insight on these two subjects.
Go to hell, Shell. Weeks after the 26th UN Climate Change Conference in Glasgow, Scotland, where leaders discussed urgent action to end the climate crisis, Shell, an Anglo-Dutch multinational oil and gas company, is pressing ahead with a controversial seismic survey of potential oil and gas deposits off South Africa's coast. The survey is being carried out off what's known as the country's wild coast, where whales and dolphins are frequently spotted. Locals are saying the survey will also impact negatively on their livelihoods.
I don't want them to operate here because if they do, we won't be able to fish here. All these sea creatures will die or we won't catch anything. They shouldn't work here. What are we going to eat? It should stop.
Environmental activists and human rights organizations have also joined locals in opposing this project. One of the activists speaks here on why they oppose the Shell's seismic survey.
You know, I mean, the key thing is that the energy agencies have already told us that we have enough oil and gas reserves, enough. We don't need more, so this is entirely speculative. We don't know that there is oil and gas there. We don't know that it will come, it will be needed in 10 to 15 years. We know that we have solar and wind energy in abundance that if we invested the money in, that we would be able to replace the coal that's going. And we also know that there is an impact on the ecosystem, you know, and it starts from the zooplankton. We know that it kills zooplankton. Now, that's the start of the food chain.
However, South Africa's Minister for Natural Resources and Energy, Gwede Mantashe, has rejected claims that the Shell seismic survey will damage the environment.
Surveys have been undertaken for decades globally in search of oil and gas. They are used for the identification of hydrocarbon-bearing structures and subsurface rock formations that must contain oil and gas. Seismic source is not an explosion or a blast in the ocean as purported by some in the media.
Now, for more on the controversy surrounding Shell's seismic survey of the South African coast, we have contacted Nimo Basse, an environmental activist, author and director of Health of Matarat Foundation. Thanks a lot for your time, sir. Now, first tell us, how will these seismic surveys affect communities living along the South African coast?
Ecosystems are not neutral spaces. They are spaces of life, of very complex relationships. And so when you have seismic surveys in coastal waters, they have direct implications for coastal communities. This is because the seismic surveys do impact the aquatic ecosystem. They do lead to the death of big sea mammals and animals. This leads to destruction of so many species. And so communities whose lives depend on the health of the coastal ecosystem have every right to be worried about what is going on in that space. Their culture, their economy, their spirituality, their social life, their education, they're all tied in a complex web with the quality of the coastal ecosystem. And so everyone, anyone living in that territory should be worried, and they have a right to be worried.
Seismic surveys have been used for many decades in both onshore and offshore mineral and oil exploration. Such surveys are also common along the South African coast. So why did this particular survey provoke public outcry in South Africa and beyond? Early December, the Eastern Cape Division of the Makanda High Court in South Africa rejected an urgent application brought by environmentalists and local communities to stop the seismic survey by Royal Dutch Shell off the Wild Coast. A protester voiced his disappointment over the judgment.
I find it absolutely ridiculous that the appeal was rejected. We know the dangers that, you know, fossil fuel consumption has done to this planet.
It's really very interesting when the judge said that they're looking for well-rounded apprehension of irreparable damage to marine life. Now, I think this is taking judicial argument to a new level. Now, the people know what the impact of seismic survey is, and they know that this seismic survey is not an end to itself. The judge has to look at what happens after the seismic survey. If the seismic survey confirmed the fossil fuel resources, either natural gas or crude oil, to be extracted, what would be the impact of the extractive activity on the livelihoods of the people, on the quality of the aquatic ecosystem, on the quality of the South African coastline? These are the bigger questions that need to be asked. What will happen to the climate when they extract fossil fuels and burn them to release more carbon into the atmosphere? So the issue is not as simple as just being opposed to a seismic survey. The people are defending their future.
However, following a successful appeal in late December, the High Court in Makanda ordered the Anglo-Dutch oil giant to immediately cease its seismic blasting along the ecologically sensitive coast. The ruling forms part of a broader court application contending Shell did not have the necessary environmental approvals.
The mess created by Shell is a clear example of how big oil companies tend to divert responsibility for the damages to the health, livelihood, and environments of communities where they operate. Now, a Nigerian villager speaks here on how Shell destroyed local environment in the Niger Delta region.
Christmas tree, this is the name that Shell gives this technology. This is the source of this pollution. This is how every other 54 from which this state and, of course, the entire world feeds.
Now, Mr. Basse, do you think what happened in Niger Delta influenced opposition to Shell activities in South Africa?
Shell's infamous activities in the Niger Delta are very well known across the world, and they provide the people with a very clear template.
This is Tehran, the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. The leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, is just about to address the people of the city of Rome on the subject of 9th of January 1978 uprising. The uprising of the people of Rome on 9th of January was very important since it acted as a precursor for the next wave of uprisings across different cities in Iran. It was, in effect, the beginning of the Islamic Revolution. Let's go over now for live key speech from the leader of the Islamic Revolution.
Events and talk about them. We shouldn't allow such great events to be put into oblivion. The 19th of day incident is also what happened on that day. Is such an event. Of course, when you discuss about this, and also what came after this event, it was a source. It had a series, a chain of events that took place, and they eventually led to the victory of the Islamic Revolution. So this, we're not looking at merely restricted incident that happened in the course of a couple of days. You look at this as a source of a great and magnanimous source of change. This and what happened later on indicates the people's religious faith, and this is the point that we are stressing on. That was clearly seen in the course of the revolution. However, the propaganda waged by those who carry grudge against the Islamic Revolution, they repeatedly cast doubt on the clear events of the Islamic Revolution. I stress the fact that what happened on the 19th of day in Rome, and also what happened afterward, they all indicate the depth of the religious faith of the public. And then relating this to a source of religious emulation was what caused this to happen. I mean, if you, as the axis of this, we had the late Imam Khomeini as a religious jurisprudence and a great fighter. Without him, such a thing would never have happened. Or the like of this incident would not have happened. No other person and no other movement would be able to do something and to turn the situation in a way so that the people of a certain town or city and then other cities subsequently and then ultimately the whole nation could not be provoked into action like this. And you are aware that during the Pahlavi regime, hundreds of dignitaries and personalities from political parties, and some of them were fighting the regime at that time. Most of them were. We had Marxists, we had others who were all threatened. They were incarcerated, they were tortured, they were executed, and they were insulted, and nothing happened. And they had no effect and influence on the public and the atmosphere of them. But for the late Imam Khomeini, they wrote a number of lines that this great incident did happen in the city of Qom, and that means that this had to do with the religious source of emulation, with the religious jurisprudence, and it had to do with religion and people's faith. That what was it? It was related to. So I should say that the majority of the important and epic events that has happened in the past 150 years, they have been of the same nature. There are some historical, some social events in which people get to the stage and they're able to get something to happen. And in all of such events, as far as I can remember, there is somebody involved. There is a jurisprudent, a clergy, that's involved in all of them, a brave one, a fighter one, one who is, has political insight. Let me cite you an example. In the tobacco, for instance, event, we had the Mirza Shirazi, who was involved during the constitutional revolution. We had the Najaf clergy and also those scholarly figures from Tabriz, Tehran and elsewhere. Regarding the Goharshad Mosque incident, we had Haji Hussain Qomi and the clerics in the city of Mashhad. On the 30th of Tir, we had Ayatollah Kashani involved. On the 15th of Khordad, 1342, that's we had the late Imam Khomeini, and some other scholars that are involved. This is a brave and clergy and with political insight who's always present on the scene. And that's the presence of that cleric that starts and makes people start taking action. Well, maybe there's an influential person who's able to, let's say, make some people do something and show some reaction at a point. But this magnanimous, popular move and, creating such waves in such a large ocean, that's only the job of a religious scholar. It's a jurisprudent who is able to do such things. And this is where you can find the reason for the antagonism of the world, arrogance, and how they feel regarding political religious leaders with a political jurisprudence, political cleric. This is how you find the roots of the enmity, because their presence is anti-imperialism and anti-colonial, and they cause such movements. So the enemy is aware of this, so this is what they oppose. They don't like religious jurisprudence. They don't like religious jurisprudence and also a political Islam. They expressly say that they oppose it. So this is a fact that needs to be heeded. Also, the profound antagonism of the part of the U.S. against the Islamic Republic of Iran can also be understood within the same context. The Islamic establishment is a symbol and epitome of people's religious faith, and it's emanated from the revolutionary look at issues, and it all emanates from faith, and that's how we look upon the world issues and our national issues. And that's why at the forefront of imperialism and world arrogance, we have the U.S. that opposes the Islamic Republic of Iran. And some people might say, then why do you oppose the U.S.? Why do you say that to America? This is, looking only at the facade. It's superficial, in our opinion. The depth of the issue is what I'm mentioning, that it's the nature of arrogance and imperialism. They instantly oppose Iran because it all has to do with religion, with faith-based principles and teachings. It's a religious movement. That's why they naturally oppose that. Well, that's one point regarding the issue of 19th of Day or January 9th incident. Another point I should mention is that the role of the religious zeal and fervor of the people that should not be ignored and neglected. The reason why I'm stressing this is that you can see that there is this political massive, let's say, political campaign is conducted to see that what comes out of this religious zeal, they're trying to be attributed to baseless and illogical violence. I should say that that's not the case. You know, the religious zeal and fervor, when it's out and visible, it's intermingled with wisdom. And that basically emanates from inside. And inside is actually a branch and part and parcel of wisdom and sagaciousness. And that shows the depth of your faith. And in most cases, when you look at this religious zeal, you find out that it has to do with, and it's intermingled with, wisdom. The scholars with the highest levels of zeal for religion, they usually, they're also sagacious people. And an instance is the late Imam Khomeini. He had the height of religious zeal. We never knew anybody at the level that the late Imam Khomeini, that the way, the level he was zealous about, you know, the way of life, this lifestyle that's religious-based and based on religious principles. Nobody liked the late Imam Khomeini was seen. At the same time, he was quite sagacious and wise and scholarly. So, on this occasion, allow me to also remember the contemporary philosopher and jurisprudent, the late Ayatollah Mesbah Yazdi. He was also in the same category. He was also a great student of the late Imam Khomeini, both when it came to religious zeal. He stood at the height, and also when it came to sagaciousness. He was a great and philosopher par excellence. So this is a brilliant combination when we talk about religious zeal, that it's a melange of wisdom and religious fervor. Now, let me offer you a little explanation so that you would realize how this uprising got to victory on the back of such characteristics. Well, the Pahlavi regime was trying to get at this. I mean, when they wrote that article in the Etelad newspaper, that was not coincidental. You know, it wasn't a rash decision. It had a big goal being pursued, and that was they wanted to shatter the holiness and the dignity and the magnanimity that the Imam Khomeini held in the eyes of the public. At his orders, people would move and take action. They wanted to shatter this. So they saw growing influence of the late Imam Khomeini in the minds of the people and the hearts of the people. They realized this. They saw this. And they wanted to the kind of demote and downgrade the status and level of the late Imam Khomeini in the eyes of the people. Of course, it was the people of Qom who gave the crushing response to the Pahlavi regime on the 19th of day, or January 9th. That would have continued if that incident had not happened in the city of Qom. It was not only that article. They would write books. They would make movies and stories about it, all aimed at actually to make Imam fall from people's grace. So it was they had targeted the core of the Islamic uprising, because the late Imam Khomeini was the axis of this and was the source of this inspiration. And that was growing in the Pahlavi regime apparatus. They realized this, and they knew that at the heart of that, at the core, was the late Imam Khomeini that they wanted to target and destroy. Now, they also had the backing of the United States and the Pahlavi regime. They were sure that whatever move they make in that connection, and their cronies, they would simply accuse the late Imam Khomeini of something extremist, and anybody who would support the late Imam Khomeini, that person would also be pressured. And they were resting assured that the U.S. is also there to back them anytime necessary, and the international reaction would not happen. So on those days, former U.S. President Carter, you know that it was in January that year, that's the 10th of day, we had Mr. Carter in Tehran. It was their New Year and January celebrations. They celebrated together with the Shah of Iran and the king at that time, and said he had a speech. He said that the Pahlavi Iran is a as an island of stability. This is one of the mistakes that he made. Later it turned out how large miscalculations they have had. Still, they're miscalculating. One of them was this point that he mentioned. He said that Iran is an island of stability. Yeah. So the Pahlavi regime thought, King Mohammad Reza felt, that the situation was pretty ripe for the uprising, for the late Imam Khomeini to be targeted and crushed. You know, of course, the Imam was in the city of Najaf at that time. He was physically away from them, but his memory, his cause, his respect, they were going to target that and try to insult that. And they found that that was the right situation, and they started what they wanted to do. So this was on the basis of calculation. I mean, they had their own pre-calculations, and they had their own maps drawn and their own plans in place. So it was the people of the city of Qom that destroyed this plan. It was a calculation of the Qom residents. And this is what the Holy Quran says. The base of Quranic verse, they staged a conspiracy, actually conspiracy, but they themselves, it got backfired, and they were targeted. They wanted to shatter the late Imam. The Imam emerged more robust and stronger, and they wanted to undermine people's bond with the Imam. It got strengthened. They wanted to undermine the uprising. The uprising got even stronger. So this was, in fact, the popular move that were related to this. I'm not saying that all people, walks of people, made this calculation, but this was a popular move, and that was a collective move that the Almighty God was inspired to the people. There was a calculation behind this, and that was a divine one, and that shattered the enemy calculations, and that destroyed their plan. It torpedoed their scheme. So, I mean, the people who on the 10th of the year 1356 and 1978, that Mr. Carter at that time, next year, I mean, the year 1978 or 79, he had to send General Heiser to Tehran so that by any means possible they would extinguish the flames of the revolution, even by massacring the people, by coup d'etat in different ways. And thank God they were unsuccessful in that, and they could not prevent the Islam revolution from happening. That was the wrong calculation on the part of the U.S. That's a miscalculation. And it's still going on. This is still the same way. I mean, regarding various issues, they make their own calculation, and then the instance of which is the what you see, the martyrdom of General Soleimani. They thought that by killing Commander Soleimani, the great movement that he was representing, and he was an icon of, he was a symbol of that, they thought that they would simply put out the flames of that movement. And you see that it just got augmented this year. That was the second anniversary of the martyrdom of General Soleimani. And you saw this great movement. Whose job was that? Who was involved in this? Who could say that he has done it and he's been responsible for that? That was only the divine role and engagement in Iran. It was not only in Iran, it was also other countries, and such a great movement and such expression of sympathy and devotion to Martyr Soleimani was all expressed. And the U.S. was not able to calculate this and is still not able to calculate this. Enemy apparatus have really been, they've been decrepit. They've been unable to do, to make such calculations when it comes to facts and realities of the Islamic revolution. When you have this wrong calculation of the status quo, then you make this wrong decisions. And by making wrong decisions, your attempts will remain futile and you will not be successful. And this will hopefully go on from now on. Well, those days are gone. The 19th of day, or January 9th, will not be forgotten either. It's still alive, and it will not be put into oblivion. The uprising got to a climax after that incident in the city of Qom, and then what people in Rome did, they all led to the great days and epic that happened in the later days of the Islamic Revolution. And the late Imam Khomeini made a return home from exile victoriously. The Islamic Revolution achieved victory in the Islamic Revolution. That's a religious democracy was established. 43 years pass since that day, and in the past decades, you see, there have been struggles, there have been lots of ups and downs, and that this incident belongs to the past, and we need to learn lessons from what happened in the past. However, we have people, when you have living people, they just don't cast a look at the past. The flashback is not enough for living people. At any juncture of its history, people are awake. They also consider the contingencies and the duties and responsibilities they should shoulder in any given period of time and juncture. And they should also bear in mind the next step, what they're going to do next, and also the prospect. This is what our people also should consider. So it's our responsibility to get to know where and what where we are standing at the moment, and also we should clarify what steps we're going to take in the future. We should know what prospect is awaiting for us, in front of us, and we should have our eyes cast on that perspective and prospect, and we should move powerfully toward that point. In this way, then this uprising will definitely achieve victory, achieve ultimate victory par excellence, and that's the pure life, as it is put in Islam, for the Iranian people. And of course, some other people have also taken this up. It's set as a role model in Iran, and others also drew from that. So people will be led toward prosperity and an Islamic style life, that's pure life, in which both we have material and the spiritual life, we have welfare, we have our body and soul, and everything is catered for. Hopefully we'll achieve that. Now we're in the middle of it. We have been halfway through. We've treaded away somehow, and it's worked for the Iranian people. The Iranian people have worked, and we have moved forward. We have made headway. Still, we need to know our responsibilities today and also tomorrow and what we need to do in the future. Well, fortunately, youth who believe in Islam, they have deep beliefs in Islam and the revolution. They are open-minded. Sometimes you realize there are some opinion polls that are conducted, and these do not show the facts regarding the Iranian people. What shows the fact is the funeral procession of Martyr Soleimani. This shows and indicates what status Iranians are, how they feel, really. This shows what their emotions are like and what they feel deep inside and what's happening in their minds. This is an experience as large, as vast as the country, Iran, and the nation in Iran. It should be that vast to be able to understand how people feel. Well, sometimes they have some opinion polls, and they do have maybe good or bad intentions. Well, they cannot form a basis to see how Iranians feel about things. Luckily, today, we have this revolutionary and faithful thought by a large number of our youths. It's a progressive thought and mentality. So on that basis, there are a number of warnings that I need to make. There are numerous warnings, but in this meeting, we are not going to expatiate on them. I'll just suffice a number of them. The first one being that all of you who are listening to me, religious zeal and fervor should be safeguarded. Do not forget that. Safeguard your religious zeal and empathy. In different junctures and when we face different bottlenecks and predicaments, it's the religious faith and deep belief in faith that changes threats and turns them into opportunities. So one instance is the Iraq-imposed war, the eight-year war imposed on the country. It was a great threat. And it was people's faith and religious fervor and zeal of our youth and people and of the fathers and mothers and wives and husbands. Well, that pushed the people to go to the battlefronts and to fight this international war waged against Iran. Then U.S. and then Soviet Union, the NATO at that time, and the countries, a number of retrogressive countries in the past, they all had joined hands to destroy Iran's Islamic establishment, and that was the cause of which was the religious faith. And when talking about the holy defense, again, there were a number of incidents in the previous year, and as we speak in the contemporary time, we had the martyrdom of respected Commander General Soleimani. That was truly a historical epic, you know, the martyrdom of General Soleimani. Nobody would think, and even our friends would think, that such an event would prove to be so great and magnanimous, and there were great blessings bestowed on us through this incident, and the people's religious identity was put forth then for everyone. It was made public for everyone to see that they were all carrying the casket and coffin of Martyr Soleimani. They displayed their unity. That's what our people did. In Tehran, we had this funeral procession. The city of Kerman and Tabriz, in different cities, we had funerals. Lots of ceremonies were held. Even in Iraq, we had that great and massive funeral procession held. If, let's say, for instance, the body of this martyr was going to be taken away to Syria and Lebanon, the same scenes would also take place there. Even in Pakistan, you would see similar events and great funerals take place there. This was the great movement of the Muslim nation that this incident showed. It was a great event, the martyrdom of a dignified personality like General Soleimani in the eyes of the enemy, in the eyes of everyone. He was considered a threat. But it was the religious fervor and zeal of the Muslim nation of Iran that turned into an opportunity. Well, we have the same instances in our past history. The 9th of the day in the year 1388 Grand Calendar, also with 2007, there was a big threat that had started. It took a few months, but on the 9th of day, people took to the streets and put an end to that incident and its ramifications, and that threat proved to be turned into an opportunity. So that's one point. That the main factor for this success is actually the turning of these threats into opportunities, and the reason for this has been people's religious zeal and fervor, that speakers, writers, and those who can influence people's minds, they should bear this in mind. Of course, it's clear that the enemies and those who oppose us, they're doing their jobs too. And they will also criticize what I'm saying now. But that's what the fact is. And the fact is that this religious zeal of the people needs to be protected. And hopefully it will be protected. Now, the second point that I want to second warning I want to make is that we should bear in mind that one of the things that the enemy is incorporating in its plannings and schemes is actually desensitizing the people regarding the principles and inspirations of the Islamic Revolution. People are sensitive about major issues of the Islamic Revolution. Anybody who makes an aggression against them, people will take sides and they want to undermine the sensitivity. They want to desensitize people. And that on the back of this massive campaign that they have launched these days on social media and cyberspace, in different ways, they're doing this. Sometimes there are a number of people, people who do not carry much merit, their thoughts and minds. They're not worth that much, but they aggrandize and overplay their words. There are people who have lots of claims, but they don't carry much, you know, weight and burden, and they question the principles of the Islam revolution. Let me give you an example. First, the rule of faith and religion. The Islamic Republic of Iran, the Islamic Revolution, happened because it wanted to see the rule of the divine rule, the religious rule. They wanted a religious geometry in place in our society, a governance to be regulated on the basis of a religious geometry and to move forward and take action. This is clear as day. People gave their lives. They gave their blood, and they offered their blood to the Islamic Revolution. For this to happen, this is part of the principles of the Islamic Revolution. They want to undermine this, or let's say not surrendering against the bullying and aggressive enemy. This is part of the principles of the enemy. We should not surrender. We should not give up. We should not give in to bullying of the enemy. Now, the fact that at the time we would negotiate, sit at the negotiating table with the enemy, well, this is a different story. Interaction is a different thing. When there is a bullying on the part of the enemy, the Islam Revolution orders us not to surrender, and we have not surrendered so far, and we will not in the future either. This is part of the principles. They want to weaken this. They, for example, question this. They say, what's wrong with this? I mean, they want to fade this away. These are the outstanding principles of our revolution, or the independence of our country, or the fight against corruption, the fight against injustice, and so on. These are the principles of the Islamic Revolution, and this is part and parcel of a soft war that's large in scale and variegated that the enemy has waged and is pursuing. We need to pay attention to this, and we should resist desensitizing. The people, men of letter and think tanks and people on different doing social media work, and those who are able to do such things, they are responsible to take action. And they should not allow this sensitivity of the people regarding these issues to be faded away by the enemy. At the same time, we should also recognize the fact that the assumption that these principles and axioms will not be beneficial for the people and for the future, this is a very wrong and unreal perception. In the past 43 years, it's not fair to make such a judgment. Anytime we made any headway, anytime we were successful and achieved something in the past four decades, it was because of the presence of the revolutionary people who struggled, they took to the stage, they worked, and they moved, they pushed us forward. Now, when it has come to scientific progress, industrial, technical, and let's say political advances on different fronts, any time we had our believers, revolutionary people who were on the stage and they did some work, we were able to do, to make some progress. Any time we were unable to do things, we found the traces of opportunists and people or people with aristocratic mentalities and non-revolutionary moves. And this is the points where we're unable to make a headway. Therefore, sticking to the principles